Every spring is a spring.
In the house.
There was once a land called Milk and Honey, where there was always plenty of everything that everybody ever needed, as long as what was needed was milk and honey. Dairy ranches and honey factories proliferated to the exclusion of nearly all other industry. This state of affairs prompted criticism by a few naysayers who thought a more diversified manufacturing base would better serve milk and honey's long-term economic growth. Plus, some individuals simply couldn't abide milk and honey.
You know, I have never had it, and it sounds absolutely grim. Milk and honey.
Mm.
Land of.
Mm-hmm.
Just, I think I would have there was a reaction on Top Chef recently where the host spit her Top Chef food into her napkin.
I imagine this is an acquired taste.
It is.
Yes.
Milk and honey,
mm-hmm.
as well as Top Chef.
You're on.
What?
You do the quotes.
Oh, it's icy. Ah, there.
Yeah.
What about Langdon's lactose intolerance?
They demanded.
Or Sequoia's hypersensitivity to bee pollen?
They were referring to two members of Milk and Honey's beautiful people council, who didn't look nearly so beautiful after they'd been exposed to, respectively, milk and honey. But they were in the minority, and the pair had maxed out their council term limits anyway, so that argument gathered about as much traction as, say, milk on honey. The citizens of Milk and Honey continued to focus on doing what they did best, until one day, the country became the milk and honey production capital of the world.
If I hear that combination again, I'm going to have the old gorge begin to rise. This could be a very unpleasant few minutes coming ahead.
Think of it as an acoustic event.
Yes.
That day, a Saturday, was one of national pride and celebration. A band played the theme from the only movie filmed entirely in Milk and Honey, Honey, I Shrunk the Milk, as scores of crumb snatchers in lifelike bovine regalia paraded down Pollen Street, waving the distinctive white and brown Milk and Honey flags. Workers at the state warehouse dispensed free milk and honey scratch and sniff patches.
I was thinking, is that parade of moomers?
I guess it could be.
Moomers.
Moomers, yes.
And the cars were beamers.
Beamers.
Mm. Okay.
The National Maritime Commissary brewed a special navy blue tea for the occasion made from the bark of bluebirds. Mr. A.K.A. Frenix, the ruler of Milk and Honey, publicly lauded the heads of the Dairy Bureau and Bee Fluids Consortium for their work by presenting each with a Met or Exceeded Inventory Goals medal. And then, at last, it was time for the entertainment.
Now I can let my breath out after that, because we won't hear these two words together again.
Three.
All eyes turned to a small, elevated stage upon which stood Bee Noah Benghazibo, Milk and Honey's premier bee wrangler. He was also Milk and Honey's only bee wrangler, for such work was indeed perilous. The venom imparted by a single bee sting could cause its victim to explode. People with chronic allergies to ordinary bee hair were advised to venture outside only when clad in chitinous body armor. Typical beekeepers wore protective exoskeletons and wielded bee-calming smokers.
What did they have? People in their hands that had like Winstons and
smoking jackets. Yes.
Benghazibo employed neither, claiming they impeded the interspecific rapport he needed to maintain with his charges. And unlike flea circuses, in which the performers wore neck harnesses to keep them from leaping to freedom, Benghazibo's bees were untethered. They came and went as they pleased. Luckily, at that moment, they pleased to fly from their eberhive, hanging from the old oak tree, up to the stage, where they surrounded their keeper with a somewhat discordant buzzing.
Mm-hmm. Sort of a Formula One buzzer.
Yes. Oh no, that's. Oh, yes.
Slowly, in a non-threatening manner, Ben Gazebo extracted from his pocket a baton. After a few practiced downbeats to get the bee's attention, he began to conduct in earnest. Amazingly, the pitch of the buzzing varied sufficiently so the observant listener could hear strains of the bee barrel polka, bee and by shadow, bee for two, and of course, flight of the bumblebee bomb. The audience applauded enthusiastically. Next, he daubed some pollen grains on his right hand and held it out, palm up. A dozen bees alighted upon it and began to perform gymnastics, a series of coordinated leaps, tumbles, slides, and turns, plus a surprisingly elegant pas de deux. The audience response was even livelier. For his finale, Ben Gazebo slowly closed his left hand over his right so that all the bicrobats were completely enclosed. An energetic buzzing issued from inside his hands. Then slowly, slowly, the bees lifted Ben Gazebo off of the stage. Not far, to be sure, only 6 or 7 inches, but it was remarkable nonetheless. The crowd exploded.
Wait.
Wait for it.
Exploded.
Yes.
Didn't somebody else explode earlier?
Or was that some poor bee sting victim?
Ah, it was the bee sting victim that exploded. Yes. I see, I understand.
Mm-hmm. As Ben Gazebo's charges lowered him to the ground, some guy who'd had one too many of the commissary's concoctions staggered up to the stage and flung the contents of his cup into the bee wrangler's face. Ben Gazebo instinctively unclasped his hands, then he dropped to the floor as the bees flew out. They made a beeline for the wrangler's antagonist and proceeded to give him what for until he, too, exploded. The next day, the Milk and Honey Gazette played down the demise of the rummy by leading off the story with this headline. Blue tea is in the eyes of the bee holder. Blue tea or beauty, take your pick, can also be expressed as
dynamical, generative processes that exist at the junctions where systems of complexity meet acoustical exploration.
A colorful phrase that's not heard often enough
in the house
of Calvus and Damien. But that's about to be rectified.
Or redacted.
Yeah. As we now hear from the slogan's inventor, a guy whose name, coincidentally enough, anagrammatizes into modern clear-headed twig, tremor-wedged enchilada, newer cathedral demigod, or get-welded red harmonica.
Yeah, get-welded red harmonica! Go out there and get yourself welded!
Anagrams that exist for a limited time only and only
in the house.
And yes, we are in the house.
In the house.
With Michael Edward Edgerton. He's got suspension points between his name on his website.
Yeah, they're not quite, they're more than ellipses. They're super ellipses.
There's five of them, I think.
So the question that comes initially to mind is, are you any relation to Harold Edgerton? It's not funny. No.
It's funny because people ask me that often.
Yes, but, professor of electrical engineering at MIT, responsible for the stroboscope.
That's right. No, I'm not.
Oh, well, that's all the questions I had.
Yeah, that's the end of the interview. Well, it's been very
nice. All right. Hey, it's been great talking to you guys.
Okay. Well, seriously, welcome to the show, Michael.
Thank you. Thanks.
You know, this show has been more than 10 years in the making.
Amazing.
And we've come to this pinnacle. So don't let us down.
And you're in the Calvus and Damien studio in Finland.
That's right. I'm in your affiliate studio here in Alajärvi, Finland. And the host would like to say hello. I think Keith Olbermann is next door. because you're affiliate of MSNBC, is that right?
Oh, yes, that's for sure. No, I think we're Fox.
Oh.
Oh, yeah, my favorite.
Yes. Anyway, well, welcome to the show. And so we're going to start right out and ask you, what the heck? You have the most amazing biography, the most amazing collection of things, and...
A dynamical generative processes that exist at the junctions where systems of complexity meet acoustical exploration.
Jesus what? Christ. My head exploded.
Ow!
Is that amazing? Who wrote that crap, man?
And since you spent so much time at Urbana-Champaign, is it possible that you spent time with the Herbert Brun?
Oh, my God. Well, yeah, he was there at the same time. I wasn't really so close with some of the folks who were closer to Herbert. But, I took part in some of his seminars and things of this nature.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. He and I shared a semester, and we didn't get along.
Mutual loathing.
Yeah, I think that's it.
You took mutual loathing, yeah, 202.
Oh, yes, to a new height, actually.
Yeah.
So, tell us about you. We have been listening to your music over the years and reading about you and just kind of wondering how you came to be.
Well,
and does it at all parallel the cartoon?
The cartoon.
Yes, the cartoon, the Edgerton cartoon.
Oh, which one is this? That's cool.
Okay. No, just go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I don't know really where to begin.
How does that the song and sound of music go begin at the very no, that's not it. That's something else.
Something else. But yeah. We know that you've sort of gotten to this state of very advanced not only composition, but you have a book out which we will talk about a little bit later. And where did you start? I mean, were you a child student, or did you start in sort of mid-teens or later life? Tell us, just sort of get us to where you became a real composer.
Yeah, no, I mean, I had some musical lessons as a kid, organ and, you know, sang in choirs and stuff like that, goofing around on guitar and other instruments like that, playing in rock bands, but wasn't really serious until I didn't really start getting into it until I entered undergraduate school, really, and that was, I'm not really sure why, I was born in 61, and I grew up in a neighborhood where we knew no other white people. It was downtown Racine, Wisconsin, and I don't know if you know that area of the country.
No, don't know Wisconsin very well at all.
But Racine is a very blue-collar town, and in the 60s it was very much segregated, and up until the time I was 5 years old, I had no white friends. And all the friends I had were, you know, African-American kids. And it was a very strange environment. And when I was 6 years old, we moved out to a little town called Sturtevant, which was like in the Hicks, and there were no black people there. So it was like really kind of a mind changing event. And their culture meant nothing. I guess, as well. Can I say that? I'm not really sure. But anyhow, so I remember when I was about, I don't know, before I was 10 years old, my mom took me to see something that I still remember to this day that I think kind of like changed the way I looked at least, or thought about music and sound and art and stuff like that. She took me to some kind of show where they had like fog machines and blue smoke and weird music. And this was probably sometimes in the late 60s. And it was at some high school in Racine, and I just remember that to this day, that kind of, like, I don't know.
Do you remember what it was, or just the effect on you?
Just the effect on me, and that there was this blue smoke and weirdo music and stuff like that. And
sounds like a performance of the Brandenburg Concerto No. 5, doesn't it?
Yeah, the Blue Smoke Concerto.
That's right, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, with a little bit of electronics under there, maybe Wendy Carlos or something. Yeah, so that was kind of how I got, I guess, thinking about these things, because I didn't really know anybody who was doing anything like that when I was young.
And so this sort of transformed your sort of view of the world, but how did you actually begin the process of becoming a musician? You said some bands and such. I mean, that was sort of the normal part of it, and then somewhere along the line something happened to you irretrievably?
Blue smoke.
So many things. I mean, I don't know. Is this kind of boring or what? But I mean,
yes, it is.
No.
Yes,
it, no. It, not
oh, it
for
isn't?
Me.
Oh, okay.
I want to hear it.
Well, we do too. That's why he's being boring, and he has to just jump up get the octane going. Wake up! It's early here.
Yeah. Do you have octane in Finland?
That's right.
I don't know.
No. So, yeah, I don't know. I think coming out of the late '60s and you know, just some of the stuff that was in the air. I mean, the pop music of that day, and that's all I kind of listened to. I don't know. We didn't really have access to, I guess, much. I just was a child of pop culture back then. But you know, there were some longer playing things, and getting into the teenager years in the '70s. I mean, some of the stuff was, I guess, a bit more progressive in terms of actual sounds and forms that the pop people were using, like Pink Floyd and some other folks. So I don't know. I think those sounds somehow had a meaning for me that I wanted to kind of explore and open up and think about.
How did that happen? Did you say, I need to do this, I'm going to go to school to do it? Or did you sort of go into the back room and start exploring with, you know, pots and pans and strings strung across
the
room?
Yeah,
or?
Yeah. My friend, he was like playing rock guitar and folk guitar and stuff like that. So we would go down to his basement and set everything up on the pool table.
Ow.
Yeah. And his poor parents, because we were down there making a racket and playing this horribly out of tune piano and recording the stuff on cassette tape. And I remember when I was an undergraduate, I think my first year, I was taking composition lessons with a guy at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, where I did my undergraduate school. And I played him this, and he just looked at me and shook his head and thought, Jesus. He thought, how do we let this guy into college? I was like, oh, well, yeah, okay, this sucks, sorry. Yeah, so we were playing around, probably like many kids interested in this stuff. But I don't know, I mean, I kind of wanted to think about the stuff and get into it deeper and deeper and deeper. So then, yeah, I entered undergraduate school at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And, well, it was amazing back then, because I entered college in 1979, and they knew nothing about contemporary music there, even the composer, because I was scoping around for, you know, what was new and what was happening. And 1979, 1980, 1981, and those people were clueless. I mean, I remember bringing them a score in which there was no key signature. It was by a contemporary composer. I don't know if it was Stravinsky or who that would have been, but the professors who I brought the music to, they had no advice on how to interpret this music. They insisted that all music had to have a key signature even, and it was bizarre. As an 18-year-old, I thought, what? I mean, you guys are professors, but surely this is not right.
Did you stay, or did you run screaming and find another place to study?
Actually, I stayed. I stayed, and I don't know. I feel pretty good about that, though, because it made me really knuckle under and learn the basics really well. And with the stuff I'm doing today, I think that really solid basic training, I don't know, I think it plays a role. I think it helps somehow.
I think we should start. Actually, do you prefer to start with a given piece, or shall we do that?
Yeah, we could start with a piece. The pieces I uploaded, Anaphora, and then Temperamental Rap might be a couple good ones.
Let's do the tempo mental rap, okay, because that's actually the one I was going to start with, and I, a couple things. I mean, first of all, I saw the score to, or part of the score to this, and I think I contacted you again after seeing that and said, what the heck? It's an enormously complicated kind of pencil score. I'm not sure if it's pencil or pen, but it's enormously dense. It is almost a work of art to look at, and I was having a great deal of trouble imagining how this piece was going to sound, and imagined it a kind of a massive kind of avalanche of sound, and it turns out not to be that at all. So tell us something about how this piece came about and your process, and then we'll play it.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, well, this was a piece that was based on a rap that was transcribed by Steve Vai of Frank Zappa Rap. And probably you all know the story, but the story was that Steve Vai, when he was a teenager, he heard some of Frank Zappa's improvisations, and so he notated them and sent them to Frank Zappa. And Zappa called him and said, "Hey, kid, you want to work for me?" And he was like a 15-year-old kid at that time. He said, "Yeah, sure, Mr. Zappa." And so he went to work for this guy, and apparently. And one of the transcriptions he did was some rap that Zappa did, and it's on his website, and it's called Temperamental Rap. And so I took this rap as a basis for six variations for this guitar piece. And in the rap, he's dealing with rhythmic complexity that he had been working with in the 1980s, and doing some things that are, well, still pretty advanced. Doing things like discontinued polyrhythms and stuff like that, where you have a quintuplet and then you know, you embed numerous layers underneath the quintuplet. And then he like splits the three from the two, like the first three, and then he like cuts it off at the end of the first three, and then he like inserts something else. And then like later in the same bar or the next bar or two bars later, you get the remainder of that quintuplet. And so he was doing kind of strange notational things like that. So I used that as the basis for this variation, and kind of try to kind of expand and explore that a little bit.
Did you have a great deal of experience notating for guitar at the time?
No, that was really the first piece that I did for guitar. There was an earlier piece, but it was crap.
So, okay.
So.
And did you work with a performer on this, or was this just sweat and learning?
We had both, because I didn't work in the same room as the guy, but it was Stefan Östersjö. I'm really mangling his name there, but he's this guitarist from Sweden who's the director of the ensemble Ars Nova. He's in Malmo, Sweden, just over the bridge from Copenhagen. And he's just a really a fantastic... I mean, not only does the guy have like all of these amazing technical skills, but I mean, he's just somebody who thinks as well. It's really, for me, a rare combination, because he's somebody who can really help bring out the process for this like almost impossibly complicated stuff, and also highly experimental stuff like in the fifth variation. He works with, you know, constantly with different composers all over the world, with all over, you know, these amazingly exotic instruments. So he gave me some hints and some pointers and some scores and, you know, things like that. But we didn't have the chance to work in the same room where I could say, how about this, and how about that, and how about this? We had to do it over the telephone, basically.
Yeah. Well, let's hear it. Our guest is Michael Edward Edgerton, and He's been on our docket for almost 11 years now, and we finally have him, wouldn't you know, seven time zones away in the Calvos and Damien studios in Finland. So here it is, three movements, for 1, 2, and 5 of Tempo Mental Rap. Thank you.
Yeah.
Our guest is Michael Edward Edgerton. That was Tempo Mental Rap. Incredibly complicated looking score and incredibly beautiful, sort of exquisitely crafted a piece.
Thanks.
Now, let's talk about the voice.
Yeah.
You start.
Well, what do you want to know? No.
I want to know everything.
We share a little something here. Now, I do extended voice work, so
yeah,
I found it fascinating to hear some of your pieces and also to learn about your book. Why don't we talk about both of those things? How you began? What inspired you to explore the voice? Was it just sort of playing around? Or did you hear somebody like maybe Joan LaBarbera or something, or did you just dive into it ab initio?
Yeah,
Wisconsinans
Wisconsinans
are known for their vocal abilities.
Oh, calling the cows.
Yes, that's right.
No, I can't escape Wisconsin. Actually, Finland looks a lot like Wisconsin. It's really... Anyhow, before I heard anybody, I was doing these kind of weird things as a kid. So we hear cartoons and people doing all sorts of weird things, so I guess that's not so weird. But yes, I started to do it, and in the School of Music as an undergraduate, and then blah, blah, blah. I mean, it was unusual, yeah. I was collaborating a lot with theater people and visual artists and dancers and doing all sorts of weird stuff.
All of those things would make sense, because those seem to be the venues that were far more open to the use of sort of voice experimentation than the kind of non-pop repertoire. I mean, we had a handful of people who were working in it, but it seemed like it was congregating more in the extra musical arts.
Yeah, exactly. I continue to do that through my 20s, and I entered, the University of Illinois for my doctorate. And Bill Brooks was there. I don't know if you guys know Bill.
I don't.
He was a member of the EVT ensemble in San Diego in the 60s and 70s, or maybe just the 70s. And then he's actually now teaching at York University, also where he was in the 70s, but... Later, he was at the University of Illinois and other places in America. So he was somebody who had worked with Kenneth Gaburo and, all of these experimental vocalists from America, and really kind of a brilliant guy. And he was directing the Contemporary Chamber Vocal Ensemble, or whatever the heck that was, at the U of I. And so I was taking part and things like this, and it was a good experience, but it was frustrating because he wasn't really good at explaining how to do certain things, and I guess kind of shy about trying to teach people how to do certain things. And so I was beginning at that time to try to figure out how to do these things on my own, and looking through libraries and not doing anything really formally, but beginning to look at physiology and acoustics on my own.
Because what I'm sure you ran into is similar to many of us. I mean, one of my first encounters was Berio Sequenza for solo voice, and I was trying to work with a singer to do this at the time. This was 1969, and it was an extremely difficult process because he was very careful about writing what he wanted to do, intakes of breaths and kind of like squeals and whispers, and he had all sorts of things tagged together, but there was no explanation. If you didn't know already how to produce some of these things, and I guess that's what inspired some of your writing.
Yeah, that's right. And so what I wanted to get a handle on, I mean, things regarding articulation and airflow, for instance, are easy enough to understand. So articulation would include things like both vowel and consonant type of sounds. So you have both kind of open and fricative sounds. And those types of things are more or less, they have an analog with language. And so that's those things are pretty easy to figure out. But the things that I really wanted to get farther into were how the, you know, the vocal folds, the things that produce the voice sounds within the vocal tract are incredibly complex. And they influence so many vocal behaviors, including things that so the vocal folds are able to, for instance, produce in incredibly diverse ways more than one tone simultaneously. So
right,
one voice.
Right.
So, so you can have two contours, in essence, coming out of one face. And there are a lot of different ways that that can happen. Also, vocal fold behavior also influences things like filtering functions, which we see when people sing overtones or like the tube and throat singing.
Right.
And things like that, yeah. And so that's one thing I really wanted to get a good handle on. And so I began looking at, acoustics and physiology on my own. And then coming in contact more closely with Trevor Wishart's work, because his work on sonic art, which came out in 1983, is really the only thing of its kind at that time and still today. And for my book, that was the only thing that was relevant, his chapter on voice, because on sonic art covers a whole lot of things, not just voice.
Right, and by the time he had written that book, a lot of the ground had in fact been explored by vocal artists and composers both, and where they sort of met in the hair pulling part of it, when trying to actually accomplish some of these things.
Yeah.
You want to give a description of some of the, or maybe we can use one of your pieces as a way to get into the kinds of sounds that we're talking about.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the reason why I sent over Anaphora, was because that this is a piece that features 56 different classes, not sounds, but classes of sounds, of two or more sonorities, meaning that there are voiced and voiced sonorities, voiced and unvoiced, 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 or three or more. Simultaneous sounds.
Can you give a couple of examples real quick on how those things sound so that our listeners have a little introduction to what they're about to hear? Because what they're going to hear immediately is not going to strike them as anything more than they might hear an episode of CSI or Law and Order.
Yeah, absolutely. That's kind of that harsh tone that gets into kind of almost a turkey-like call, which a lot of vocal new music singers have been doing for the last 40 years.
Right.
But in particular, there's one that's, oh gosh, and I don't want to try this right now, but it's something called a glottal whistle, and that's where a singer basically kind of stops the oscillation of the vocal folds, and you produce kind of like the sound when you kind of valve off a balloon. And well, it sounds like a whistle, but the whistle doesn't come from the lips, but it comes from inside your throat.
I think I can do it. I don't think I can do it right now.
Yeah.
I don't think I can do it right now.
Yeah, and so there's a she does this Angie. I don't know, a couple minutes into the piece, maybe two or three or four. I forget. But that's something that is able to be combined also with a normal oscillation of the vocal folds, which she does later in the piece, and so that's just one class of sounds that she's exploring. Other classes could be singing a normal tone and adding some kind of bilabial frication, for instance. So you make a buzz with your lips and then you sing behind it, which is pretty common.
Right.
And so that would be just one other class. So that piece, Anaphora, has 56 different classes. Some of them are more pedestrian, like the one I just described, but some are not, like this so-called glottal whistle. And we've been kind of exploring other ways of producing the voice and voiced categories of
what does that mean? Explain what that means.
Oh, so any sound produced with the vocal folds is a voice sound. But any sound produced basically above the vocal folds would be an unvoiced sound. So basically noise sounds in the upper vocal tract.
And what or, when we speak, we are using normally combinations of both of those.
That's right, because the when I say that's right, all the S's and T sounds would be unvoiced. Whereas a Z would be a combination of a voiced and a frication, and a fricative sound. So an S and a Z are basically the same tongue position, slight variations, but the main difference phonetically would be that the S is unvoiced and the Z is voiced.
All right, now that we have a little bit of background in this, let's listen to it. It's a long piece, so we're going to have to sort of settle back and turn the volume up because this is one of those pieces that is so intense. It starts out pretty much at the top of the level, and then it has all the variations from there. But this is the kind of piece that, especially if you're living in an apartment, you want to turn it up. Our guest is Michael Edward Edgerton. This is Anaphora, and the soloist is
Angie or Angela Rademacher from Berlin.